Okay, this is Jonathan Bernstein conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Steve Harding. We are in the Holiday Inn in Lubbock, Texas, at the Texas Association of Museums Texas Association of Museums meeting, and it is about 3:30 on what is today's date? It's April 11th, 2002. Now, Mr. Harding, can you start off, I guess, with a brief biographical sketch of yourself growing up, leading to your decision to enter the military?
Okay. My father is a career military man. He was a colonel in the Army. And so we kind of grew up, my sisters and I grew up all over the world and all over the states. Huh. But I guess my formative years were in Arizona. And I grew up in Sierra Vista, Arizona, when Fort Huachuca was very young. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we lived in the on what was called Colonel's Row, these old former cavalry billets, and would listen to retreat every evening and reveille every morning on the parade field. It was an old cavalry fort. Went to high school at a quasi-military school in Massachusetts, Tabor Academy, and graduated from there. Came back to my parents at that time were living, when I graduated, were then living in Kentucky. Went off to college in Utah. Went to Brigham Young University. I'm not a Mormon. It was at the suggestion of an influential great aunt that I went there. It probably wasn't the best thing for me to do. I didn't really fit in. And so I was faced with the draft. And since my father was a career Army guy, I elected to join the Marine Corps.
Oh.
Which I guess is a little bit revolutionary for, you know, revolutionary spirit to do something other than your dad. Hindsight, I probably would have joined the Air Force. I
mm-hmm.
Would have much preferred to wipe wings than do what I ended up doing. But nonetheless, joined the Marine Corps and went to Parris Island, South Carolina for boot. Then went to Camp Lejeune for infantry training, and then on to Special MOS school at San Diego for communication school and radio telegraph school, and trained there for however many weeks that was. I don't recall right now, some period of time, 6 months or something like that. And then you know, at that time you're given the option to fill out where do you want to go. You know, you want to go to Asia, you want to go to go to the United States, you want to go to Europe. And so, you know, Asia was my last choice, but at that time Asia was Uncle Sam's first choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so pretty much everybody in my unit from radio school was possessed orders to go to Vietnam. We went off. You know, it was a rotation war where you fly on an airplane full of people who are not of your unit. You don't have any idea what your unit is, really. Although I was assigned to, once I arrived in Vietnam, I can't remember, I was given my orders to Anglico,
mm-hmm.
which is a very specialized Marine unit. It's a Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company,
mm-hmm.
and our role was to support usually foreign troops, not U.S. Marines or U.S. troops. Sometimes we could be attached to Army, but our role was to bring America's military might to bear on an enemy in support of a foreign force.
Mm-hmm.
So that, as a Marine, a team of two U.S. Marines would be attached to a combat group of varying sizes, anything from a company down to a reconnaissance platoon. And our role was all helicopter support, and that would be medevacs and resupply and gunships, anything that would typically be HSD, all fixed wing and rotary wing air support, and that could be Spooky or it could be an Arc Light or it could be, you know, anything that or just fixed wing air support, naval guns if we were within the area. If we were within range of naval guns, it could be rocket ships. It could be anything from the New Jersey to just a rocket ship off the coast, or a destroyer and some 5-inch. And I guess that's the that's you know kind of the you know medevac, of course.
Okay.
And got attached once we got to once I got to Vietnam. I went solo to my unit. I was flown into Da Nang because I was a Marine, and then informed after sleeping several nights on the floor in Da Nang's airport that I had to go to Saigon because my unit had its headquarters. Our colonel was in Saigon. Our air officer was in Saigon. So I flew to Saigon. Indeed, our air officer was there. Was outfitted with all the various things you need, get a weapon, get you know all the stuff that you need, and then told to go back to Da Nang because I was being attached to the Chunhyang, the Blue Dragon, a reinforced brigade of Korean Marines who were on the Batangan Peninsula south of Chulai, or just a little north of Chulai, I can't remember which, north or south of Chulai. And so back on a plane, back to Da Nang. Get to Da Nang, waited around again another couple days until finally I could find a flight to Chulai, went down to Chulai. By then I had hooked up with another Anglico guy who was also going to the same unit, and we arrived at Chulai and were hanging around outside, waiting around this kind of desolate airport, not having any clue where we were going. And a guy, this guy suddenly kind of comes out of the west in a Jeep going about a million miles an hour, and it was some sergeant with a red handlebar mustache, and he's in camouflage utilities, but not the kind of camouflage utilities you see today. They were the old kind. They were like jungle on the outside and brown on the inside, the old Marine ones, you know. Yeah. And well, this is kind of exotic. And anyway, he pulls up to us. He says, "You guys Anglico?" I said, "Yes, Sergeant." He says, "Got a gun? Yeah. Got bullets? Yeah. Lock and load, hop in. Let's go." Oh, I said, "Oh, man, here we go." So so anyway, we rode out to, it's a pretty good ride, to where the Korean Marines were. And we unloaded. And within 2 weeks, I was on my first operation. And our operations there, we had mountains. We had three mountains that we controlled, and pretty much the VC controlled everything else. It was a free fire. And we had Hill 101 and Monkey Mountain, and I can't remember what the other mountain was right now. Mm-hmm. But basically, these were like a fire base, and then we would go on patrol from there. And we went on our first operation. It was a big sweep. And we swept around. It was my first experience getting shot at. The old-timer, this guy, let me carry the radio all the time. We were supposed to switch back and forth, but me being the new guy, mm-hmm. didn't realize that. So I got to carry the radio all the time until my back gave out, and he finally agreed to carry it. But our role was, at that, you know, as I said, mostly as a forward air controller. When we get contact, it would go to point of contact, figure out what we needed. The Koreans were kind enough to give us bodyguards, at least two guys, two riflemen that stayed with us, mm-hmm. to make sure that we didn't get popped because we represented a lot to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd run our airstrikes and do whatever we had to do, medevac their guys, get in resupply. And after about 20, 30 days in the field, you come back to your fire base and start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And then we didn't know it was Big Tet, but just before Big Tet, our unit was on the move. We were going to be moving to Hoi An, mm-hmm. which is it's in the rocket belt south of Da Nang. And so we had a battalion-sized, well, it was actually the whole brigade was moving. Our whole brigade moved north to Hoi An, but our whole battalion at the same time. So we had our three companies from our battalion starting in Hoi An and then going out old French Route 1 to some old French forts that were located along that old route, and set up a series of fire bases along there. And that was our TOR for the balance of the time I was in country. We had some pretty good shoot 'em ups from time to time, and conflicts with our enemies. I got hit in March, and medevac to, which was the end of Tet was kind of winding down, but really Hoi An was overrun during that time. We came into just devastation, and we had no fixed base, so we were kind of on the move. We're a unit in transition, and so was the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And but we didn't have a fixed base to come to, so we were kind of really kind of on the run all the time. And with Hoi An was gone, it was overrun. We had to go in and take back Hoi An, and and then move out to these other fire bases. And it was a very chaotic time. But finally got medevac to Cameron Bay, of all places, very far south. Mm-hmm. And that was a good experience to get out of the the storm for a while, and get fixed up, get some beers, and get back. And then within another few months of that time, I think I got a little bit of early cut and came back to the States. But I guess all in all, probably the best thing about being an Anglican Marine and not being attached to the U.S. Marines was, one, being attached to the Koreans. They were great folks, and but no one knew who we were. Mm-hmm. We wore a different uniform. We could be anything we wanted to be. I mean, I had pockets full of different Korean insignia, and I just put them on indiscriminately. And so if I wanted to be a lieutenant, I'd put it on. And I mean, well, it's corporal, but I was a lieutenant for a day. And, you know, most U.S. Marines didn't know what that rank was, but U.S. officers would, and they'd pop salutes at me. We'd have a lot of fun being able to be whatever we wanted to be, because which is an Army slogan, I know, but we'd get to be whatever we wanted to be because no one knew who we were. We were also exempt from the two-beer rule, which the Marines had in I Corps, because nobody knew who we were, so we could go to the Korean Club and have a few, and we could go to the Marine Club and have a few, and we could go to the Officers Club and have a few. We'd go wherever we wanted. So, which we didn't have at our base, but when we were in Da Nang, we could go to these places. Our bases were, you know, very, very Spartan, to say the least. We'd get rocketed from time to time out at our little fire bases. My call sign, by the way, was Ham Salad, which I thought was a great call sign. It was Ham Salad 14 Charlie. And our little bases got probed severely from time to time. And I wasn't there when it got overrun, but it did get overrun. Not obliterated, but overrun, meaning that the enemy had penetrated the wire and penetrated the wire on the other side. Right. And we got gassed. We were constantly under pressure. We had five helicopters down in a company-sized position. Wow. It was pretty serious. We called the pilots were calling our unit Little Kaysan. They did not want to fly in. They did not want to fly into that place. It was just too much stuff, all 360 degrees. And anyway, that's
all right, well, let's step back a second. Okay. I guess. Well, first of all, what year did you graduate from high school?
65.
Okay. I guess going into boot camp. First of all, did you have any expectations? What was your first impression?
First impression was, oh shit, why am I here? You know, I mean, these guys get on this bus and they're really mean and what have you. And I had a brother-in-law actually who was in the Marines, and he was at Parris Island. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's neither here nor there, but I don't know. Maybe I thought I could always escape and go find Tom. Mm-hmm. But
did you talk to him before going in?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to him, but I mean, he wasn't a mentor or anything. I didn't mentor anything. I made a decision and I just went and did it. And surprised my dad with it, and he said he was okay with it. He didn't care, you know.
Okay, go.
So really, it was just kind of the shock of being in this environment. But I'd been around the military, and I'd been in, I knew what the environment was. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew what discipline was.
Okay.
So I wasn't. Totally surprised.
Just and were your instructors at basic Vietnam vets?
They were. Yeah, two of three were. Okay. Two of three were. Yeah, Sergeant Altizer and Sergeant Prater, I think, were both vets. There was one other one. I can't remember his name.
A lot of invocation of, you know, this is what you're gonna, you know, have to know for in order to survive.
Well, that was the whole boot camp experience. Was you know, you're gonna get killed, maggot. Okay. And some, I mean, things were very rudimentary because this was 66.
Okay.
You know, we didn't know a lot that we know now. Mm-hmm. The Marines had been in country since what? Since 66,
yeah,
you know, so really we just,
six.
So we just had barely gotten there, and these guys were just back.
Okay.
So it was, you know, it was a new experience. They just were developing these training programs for, you know, trying to find booby traps and things, which,
And Was there any booby traps or counterinsurgency instruction during boot camp?
Oh yeah, little bits, booby trap instruction. Mm-hmm. That didn't help. Mm-hmm. We still lost most of our guys to booby traps.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Well, they were Koreans, but still, yes, most guys were booby traps and snipers.
Hmm. Okay. I guess moving on to AIT and then or advanced training and then. And then your technical
Camp
training.
Pendleton?
Yeah.
I always felt that was pretty rudimentary. I mean, that was really, you know, okay, go shoot the bazooka, shoot it once. You missed. You're done. You know,
yeah,
you
just, okay.
Okay. Now what? You know, I mean, if I had really had to go out in the field and use any of that training, I'd have been lost. Mm-hmm. I would have really been lost.
Okay. But, they're still using bazookas in 60s?
No, no. It's, well, that's what you trained on.
Right, okay.
I mean, we didn't have Johnny Laws. I mean, I guess we would have, they're probably too expensive to really use in training.
Okay.
So we, you know, used a bazooka.
What rifle did you train on?
M14. Carried an M14
really?
In Vietnam.
Okay.
The Koreans had M16s. We had M14s. We got them about halfway through, but I carried an M14.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of it?
I thought it was a great weapon. Mm-hmm. I thought it was terrific. I used to have competitions with the Koreans. We used to try to shoot down trees. And I said, I can knock that tree down with 6 rounds. The Korean was, oh, no, I do it with, you know, 4. So we tried. We take a little tree and, you know, shoot it with the 6 rounds, see if you knock it over.
Very cool. I guess moving on to your specialized training, was that specifically training for naval gunfire support?
No, that was radio telegraph. All the gunfire and FO stuff was on job.
Okay.
If you had gone into Anglico and trained in Hawaii, which was home base for Anglico, you'd have gone through all that and you'd have been a trained Marine when you came out.
Right.
But this was another time and another place, and it was kind of like, you're going to 3rd Marines, you're going to 1st Marines, you're going to 3rd Marines, you're going to Anglico, you're going to 3rd Marines. Oh, okay, what's that? You know, and you end up going there. As it turned out, I much preferred. I'm glad I went there.
It was sounds like it was a unique experience.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the radio training like? I mean, what kind of equipment were you using? Prick 25s?
Well, yeah, Prick 25s. And, first it was radio telegraph. I mean, you had to learn Morse,
right,
which you never used, but it was interesting to know.
Okay.
So you had to train, learn Morse, and then you went through the usual with Prick 25s. And what were those vans? TSC-15s, I guess, TSC-15 vans. And then there were step downs to Jeep-mounted radios, too, that I don't remember their numbers. The only thing we ever used was a Prick 25.
Right.
All of our communication with aircraft was all Fox mics, so we didn't use any UHF.
Okay.
When we were calling, when we were working with fixed wing, we were Phantoms and stuff. They'd all be Fox mics, so we didn't have to have a go between for them.
Right.
But we did for ArcLight or anything that was really serious, there was always there would be a Blackbird that would be not meaning
not
Blackbird,
the SSR,
but a spotter plane that we would talk between.
Naval
guns talk right to the maybe there was a spotter, I can't remember. I thought we talked right to the ship. Can't remember, because somebody would come up on the radio and say, "Ham salad, this is whatever their call sign," and you knew to expect that that was your ship, and your ship had arrived.
Did you ever work with the USS Boston?
No. That I know of.
Had a friend who was a naval gunfire support station in Boston.
Yeah, I don't know. If she was off, the Batangan maybe, and or she was off.
I think she may have been.
Yeah.
I'll have to check. But all right. Okay, getting in country. First impression.
Chaos. I mean, it was you know, the smoke, and it was Asia. It was a new place. It was new smells. It was you know, a lot of little motorcycle-y things that gave a lot of exhaust. I remember the exhaust smell was just, and the heat just hit me first. And you know, it was kind of exotic. You know, the neat little putt-putts going around. Of course, you're looking around wondering who's going to shoot you first.
Right.
You know, and then the parade by. I saw it in a movie once. You know, the old guys leaving, the new guys coming. Well, that was a reality. You did pass the old guys going back, and they're all, you know, flipping the bird and telling you're going to get killed and shit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an old man. Thanks for the welcome.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're in your really green utilities and looking very pale and what have you. And, you know, of course, I came over with all Army, you know, mostly Army. I came over with all Marines. That's right. But none of them were Anglico.
Uh-huh.
Of course, then I had to go back to Saigon, which I'm not back to Saigon. I had to go to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
which was actually a pretty good experience. I mean, really? I sort of kind of got into that, and then I had to go back north.
How long were you down there?
Just a couple of days, but it was long enough, you know, to realize these guys had it good. Uh-huh. They were going out to dinners and these parties. They were these hotels, and I mean, it was great. They had a great life. Mm. They really had a great life. And they were the ones who, they were the rear echelon guys. They didn't have to go on the field or anything. They just sit back there and welcome us, you know, give us our uniforms and stuff, and then we go off to do their bidding.
Now, were you given any briefings or anything when you, you know, what to expect getting in country?
I suppose. I don't remember any of it. Okay. I mean, it's like any kid getting a briefing.
Right.
Know, huh?
Right. Up, yeah, I know what you mean.
What do you say?
Yeah.
I was in the back.
Okay. All right. Now, okay, so you've gotten in country. You're told you're going to Anglico. Did you have any idea what it was?
No clue.
You know,
what Anglico was?
Yeah.
No clue. No clue. Okay. No clue.
And then, of course, you know, being attached to a foreign unit.
Again, no clue. Yeah. And then arriving and going, all right. And they, you know, it's interesting because the Koreans were great guys. Mm-hmm. We had some wonderful experiences. Lost a lot of them, though. I mean, a lot of these guys went back in body bags, and most Americans don't know that we had a lot of Koreans over there. This was a reinforced brigade. The army had, the Korean army had the White Horse division there, and so they had some, you know, a sizable force there. And I know that your commander, what's his name, was saying, you know, all his anecdotal stories about Koreans, but you know, I didn't want to hear that. These were my friends. These were my Marines, and I don't care. I don't give a shit about Auckland, New Zealand, or Australia, or these other guys, or him. Having to arrest some Korean officer because he was drunk. That doesn't matter to me. Mm. But and oh, by the way, it wasn't the Korean people who forgot the Korean War. It was the American people. Yeah, the Koreans remember, and that's why those guys were there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were getting their little roses for a war. They had no clue. Mm. Well, not that we did, but they had even less clue why their boys were dying. Mm. I forgot the question.
Basically just... impression on being attached to a Korean unit.
At first it was kind of scary. It was kind of weird, you know, because you're there with your Americans. You bond immediately with the Americans because everyone out there is yet another somebody else. You didn't know who they were, and the food was foreign. But you know, pretty soon they kind of take you under their wing. Somebody takes you under their wing. You're a young guy and stuff. And I remember it was a Sergeant Lee who took me under his wing. And he kind of escorted me through everything and made sure, you know, my bodyguards were with me, and you know, and then the captain would take you under his wing because we were very important, remember, to them. And so we would get to, you know, go and have drinks in the captain's bunker, and out in the field we'd sometimes have dinner with the captain's guys. And of course everything was done in the field. Our food was all communal, and so you just kind of, we'd give them some C's to, you know, some different C's, and they'd add their K's to it, and some kimchi, and whatever we found that day. We'd have guys who'd find stuff, like find a chicken go in, or whatever, pig, you know, vegetables and stuff, that all goes in the soup. The machine gun guys would do the rice, and then we'd all just eat together, you know, so it's... Yeah, they always have good food. Spicy food.
Uh-huh.
But I liked it. That was
good stuff.
Kimchi's good stuff. Kimchi's good stuff. And it was the underlying flavor. That and doenjang paste was the underlying flavor of everything we ate.
Really?
So,
excellent. When exactly did you arrive in country?
Oh God, the day? I have no.
Well,
I don't remember.
Don't need the day. Just I don't know, year, month.
It was 67.
Okay.
Probably in, in August, maybe?
So
67, August, September of 67.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So.
Right. Now, first engagement.
First engagement coming off the hill.
Know, impressions. What was it like getting shot at?
Well, I didn't know. I was the only one who was standing up.
Okay.
I was the only one who was standing up, and my partner says, you might want to get down a little bit. You know that popping noise? That's incoming. Oh, okay. So I got down. But all the Koreans were already down one. And if it was VC, we always had this, well, this was later. Of course, you learn these rules actually probably 2 weeks later because you learn them very quickly. If it was VC, you knew you could stand up a little bit. Mm. And then, and if the second volley, you go down on one knee. Third volley, they might be getting a little close. You might have to go down a little bit further. Mm-hmm. If it was NVA, first volley, and then you better be flat, because a little bit better shots.
Were a lot of your engagements against NBA, ABC?
Well, we had some engagements that were definitely NBA, and some that were, definitely VC.
Okay.
So, but we had pockets on the Batangan. We had a huge body of enemy that we caught them one night. In fact, we were occupying some hills, some sand dunes, and we'd been on this operation forever, just forever. And we had these sand hills that we were occupying, and I had some tanks, tractors. Marine tractors, LVTs, LSTs, not LST,
LVTs.
LVTs.
Yeah.
But not the ones with the bladder underneath. I can't remember what they call.
Okay.
But anyway, they were very lightly armed, very lightly armored. They had a bladder of gasoline underneath, and they had a 30 caliber machine gun on top with sandbags around it. And we had this group of Marine tractors who were trying to reach us. I don't recall why. I guess they were supposed to link up with us or something. But anyway, they got caught in the middle of this field, rice field way down, and we could see the engagement. And I remember calling a strike, and I had I think it was helicopter guy. I had gunships up that night, and they popped a couple flares. But I was doing this from the edge of a sand dune. Almost doing it in my mind like a video game, with my radio, bringing him in as this lieutenant is telling me how far in I ought to come, and then I bring in another 10, and then I bring in another 10, and bring in another 10, and they did not get wiped out. They got pretty well shot up, but they did not get wiped out. And the next morning we linked up with them. But from that same position, about a couple weeks later, we had a moon come out where we could see what seemed to be a very long line of movement. And so I called and got a spooky up, and we dropped a couple of flares, and sure enough, we had like a trail of people coming out. And spooky pretty much obliterated that entire grid. And we went the next day to check it, and there were very, very few bodies. There were body parts, but there were very, very few bodies, so obviously they've been able to cart things around, but so we don't really know what our damage was for that. But golly, it just had to be devastating. I mean, when you find hands and things, they obviously cleaned up in the middle of the night. We didn't go till the next morning, and it took us a while to get there. So by the time we didn't get there till noon, so they had plenty of time to clean up. So,
were these NVA?
Well, we don't know. That was not an NVA. It was probably mostly civilians, actually. Mm-hmm. Really? I really want to know. I was probably VC and civilians coming out. No, NVA, when we moved up to Hoi An, that is where we had more contact with NVA. In fact, we were about less than a couple miles from My Lai when it happened. We saw the smoke from My Lai. Yeah. AmeriCal division.
Excuse me. That's me.
Okay. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, we walked into it was in roughly that same area. We walked into a We'd been in a running kind of gun battle for a couple days, and it was kind of that Tet period of time.
Okay.
And we walked into this little village-like area, and kind of put our gear down and spread out, and everybody's kind of sitting around. And all of a sudden, NVA regulars are popping out of holes around us. We kind of sat down in the middle of a whole bunch of bad guys, and they were just kind of coming up, and we were just sitting down, and it was like, oh man, it was it was pretty wild for a few minutes until they decided to stay down and they got out, and then we regrouped and we got out, and we left immediately as well, and just and obliterated that grid square with whatever I could find. But you couldn't find much during Tet. I mean, it was not a good time. Calling airstrike.
Aware of what was going on across the country during Tet?
We were sure aware of what was going on around us. But yes, we were, just because pilots would tell us, they'd be coming back from something, and you'd say, we're in deep shit and I need something, and so, well, I got a divert for you. So you'd get some, Air Force divert, and the guy coming, he's got, well, I got, 20 rounds of 20, Mike, I'll give you that. Done, bye. Of course, the Air Force would never drop below 10,000 feet anyway,
right.
So they did not understand close air support.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one service that did, and that was a Marine pilot.
Right.
Yeah.
I've heard stories of Marine Phantom pilots. In fact, a guy from the AmeriCal division who I interviewed would say.
Hard luck division.
Yeah, Marine Phantom pilots coming in below the treetops.
Oh, yeah, well, for sure. Yeah. AmeriCal, they were a funny group. We had a little standoff with the AmeriCal one day.
Really?
Yeah. We had our little, like I said, our positions were very small, company positions, and they were, you know, we were surrounded by bad guys. And in fact, we had them digging trenches into our positions. I mean, it was pretty. they were out to get us. but anyway, we were sitting there one day, and this all of a sudden these Indians pop up on the ridge out there, and a tank comes pulling up. And you know, obviously we certainly hoped it wasn't the NVA, but we're pretty convinced it wasn't. So my partner and I said, okay, listen, we'll go out. And so we took our bodyguards, and I think maybe another squad or fire team or something came with us, and we walked out to see who these guys were. And there was this very nervous American captain out there looking down at our AmeriCal, Army guy, looking down at our position. You know, I come up and we go, we're good guys. You know, we're peaceful. And we told him who we were and everything. You know, he looks at us very skeptical, but I took off my helmet. I've got blonde hair. Mm. You know, we're okay. Not anymore, but I did. But anyway, so we were okay. And then they decided they were going to settle in and make their camp, and they make their camp, and my partner and I were standing around. We hadn't been back to our rear position in God knows how long, and our boots were falling off. The big holes in the side of our boots. We smelled bad. We hadn't had baths or anything. These guys were flying in ice cream and all. Do you think they offered us any? No.
No?
Those pricks. God, I could have. Man, I hope they all got wiped out. But they were funny. I mean, they would advance, like, the next day they moved on. They were doing something. They were in RTOR, but they were doing something. I'm not quite sure. But they would call in artillery on a tree line, obliterate the tree line. Then they'd move to that tree line. Then they'd call in artillery on the next tree line. And then they'd move to the next tree line. They'd call in artillery on the next tree line. They'd move to that tree line. So, oh, shit, man. By the time you get there, there's nobody there. They're all gone anyway.
Right.
You know, they scared them away. We could have told them some tree lines to go to, though. Boy, I'll tell you. We had one that we could never penetrate. It was on the other side of our position from where those AmeriCal guys were. Mm-hmm. And we had gone in there many, many times and come back with many, many casualties. We'd never been able to get into that tree line. It was just so loaded with bad guys. We took, you know, heavy machine gun fire. We'd take rocket fire. We'd take all kinds of shit out of the tree line. We'd run airstrikes. We'd run artillery in there. And I was close enough to U.S. Marine 8-inch and U.S. Marine tanks. We could fire U.S. Marine guns in there, which I could do a lot more accurately than some of the Korean FOs. That's me.
Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, the tree line. Anyway, we made many attempts to penetrate. These were the guys that were digging the trenches into us, but we could never get to them. And we'd done everything we could. We'd fire, I mean, all the time. And we even had two tanks,
really?
In our U.S. tanks. We had some tanks that had come to rescue us. Mm-hmm. One of them was blown up because it got hit a mine on the way. Right. And then we had to have a tank retriever come get that. And then they were all stuck there because we couldn't get out. And we had the five helicopters in the zone. This was that one.
Oh.
And it was really a crazy place. And then they're digging trenches, and then we're trying to get into their tree line and couldn't. And so finally, Arclight City.
Okay.
And that finally made it a little more penetrable. We still never really penetrated the tree line.
Okay.
Because it was still infested. Mm-hmm. But we hope with that effort that
how did that those events unfold? I mean, working with, I mean, losing five helicopters in the tank and everything there. I mean,
well, just day to day, just day to day. We just had, there were so many bad guys, 360, that, you know, you'd bring in, you'd need to medevac some guys, and you'd bring in your medevac helicopter, you'd be sitting on the ground, and those turbines, you know, they can't take too much.
Right.
The CH-34s were bulletproof. Mm-hmm. I mean, those things could fly through anything, but, you know, they weren't very fast. They were very slow.
Yes.
And so, you know, they were vulnerable, but in a different way. The pilots were vulnerable. They were so slow, and it was all bubbled in the front.
Yeah.
But the 46s, they, you know, they hit them in the right spot, and there were a lot of right spots. They go down.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's what we were using mostly was 46s.
Okay.
And for resupply, the guns would, you know, just zip around, and nobody was shooting at them. They knew what they were shooting at.
Yeah.
And so we just had, you know, just bird after bird. You take them out, and you try to go low level down to the river. You take something, and you know, he'd need to come back to someplace, and this was the only place he could come back to, or he'd be sitting on the ground. He'd take it and have to just shut down, and we'd just move him off to the side until we had a parking lot full of them.
Yeah.
This is only a company position.
Yeah. Damn, we're running out of space real quick.
Really, you know, valet.
Yeah. Wow. So when, I guess when the medevacs were coming in, would there be, I mean, would the gunships come and load to cover them? Or
oh yeah, sure, just, you'd have cover. You know, I mean, they'd be, but you don't necessarily, if they're not, if the enemy's not shooting, you don't know where they are. You can't shoot everywhere, so they'd just be, you know, kind of covering.
Right.
But you don't know where to shoot until somebody pops up and starts to shoot, and then you get a fix on them, and you can give the gunship someplace to shoot at, and keep their heads down. But they, you know, they'd strafe a tree line or something where you thought they might be, and the Korean captain always wanted me to go out there, and he wanted me to run napalm on all the tree lines around us so we could kind of burn them down. I said, I don't think I can convince my AO to do that, you know, to burn down your tree lines. Actually, we could have done it, but it just didn't seem like a wise investment. So we took the tanks out, and we knocked down some trees and just spread some diesel over it. Once they decayed a little bit, we burned them.
Okay. Now, how far, I guess, was your position from the tree lines?
Oh,
rough estimate.
150 meters.
Okay.
Maybe.
So it's fairly close.
Yeah, it was pretty close. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. All right. Now, I guess what was your favorite form of support to bring in? What was most effective?
Nape and snake.
Right.
Yeah. And that was nape and snake.
Okay.
Was the ordnance of preference, I guess.
And some fast movers.
Yeah. Big stuff. I mean, 500 pound and stuff like that. It just it was too much for close air support. I mean, if you had a fixed target and you knew it, I mean, if you had a house or something like that, yeah, okay. But I mean, houses. Yeah, I shouldn't say this, but I mean, we used to blow up houses just for fun because they were there, not necessarily because we had a target in it.
Well, I also would think that. I mean, tactically speaking, I mean, it could be a sniper position.
Sure.
Or something.
So, yeah,
I mean,
that's right. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, there is
some
military justification for it. But okay. Now, what types of gunships were we working with?
Huey's mostly.
E-model Huey's.
Yeah, I don't recall any Cobras. Maybe, but I think the Army had most of those. I don't know if the Marine Corps had too
Marines
many.
Marines didn't get them until 69.
Yeah.
But, okay, just wondering.
Well, and of course, now they were gunships were always a preference too, but I thought you meant fixed wing. But gunships were always good, and Spooky was fun. I mean, Spooky was always fun, and the pilots were cool. Hamzell, this is Spooky. Hey, Spooky, it's Spooky. How you do? They were very cool on the radio.
Very cool. All right, I guess we'll just finish up real quick. I'm trying to think of what else to go on. Let's see. Now, of course, during Tet, a lot of stuff going on. Also, there were a number of other significant events going on. LBJ's decision not to run for re-election. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, the big things that happened to us was RFK getting shot, I think, and Martin Luther King. I mean, those were big deals. Or RFK when I was there, I guess Martin Luther King after I got back and I was at Quantico.
Okay.
But those were big deals. RFK was a big deal because the Koreans questioned it. They said, why did you kill him? I said, well, I didn't, but you had to justify it to another. We always had to justify politics to the Koreans, which kept us on our toes, okay. I guess, because they were coming at it from a totally different point of view.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Now... So you were, I guess you were coming home, say, August of 16?
Actually, I got a little early cut. It might have been June, July.
Okay. Oh, actually, yeah, that's right. You mentioned getting hit. What happened there?
Well, we were out on a little op, and we started to take some incoming, and the guy, we were running over to grab some cover. We had a tank with us, and the Korean in front of me stepped on a mine. He took the bulk of it, and I took the rest of it. And unfortunately, it killed him. And we had a little shoot 'em up for a while, and then had to get started with medevacs. And since we had a tank, and we realized we were in the middle of a minefield, I had the tank do a neutral steer, clear out the mines, and that was our LZ.
Okay.
And then got my Koreans out that were hit, and I stayed with the unit till I guess, till medevac, until resupply that night. And then I went out. And I said, you know, I probably could have stayed, but you know, a warm bed and a meal was nice. So, and I was hit after all. Yeah. So, but it wasn't life threatening. It was a little bit, you know, cuts along here and a little bit of shrap down my arm. And so.
Okay. Did you have any R&R while you were in country?
I did.
Okay.
Went to Taipei. Taiwan.
How was that?
It was all right.
Yeah. I suppose refreshing change from being in the jungle.
Yeah, it was all right.
Mm. Now, the areas you were operating in, were they primarily jungle? Or?
No. We were. I mean, there was some jungle. There was some, but we were in rice paddies, savanna, what you call forest, I guess,
okay,
more than triple canopy jungle,
right,
around Da Nang.
A
lot of fortified villages and forest that was fortified forest, but not triple canopy stuff.
Okay.
We didn't have that.
All right. You had mentioned wearing different uniforms. What exactly were you wearing?
No, we wore a Korean camouflage,
okay,
uniform, which was an old Marine uniform,
mm-hmm,
which was jungle utilities on one side and desert utilities on the other
sort
side.
So it was pattern.
Yeah, so it was just unique,
okay,
in that nobody else wore that.
All right.
And so people wondered who we were. Plus, we wear different insignia.
Okay.
The Korean insignia is different than U.S. insignia.
Okay.
And we'd be traveling with Koreans, which,
yeah,
you know, was different.
Yeah. Okay.
But people were always very nice to us. You know, when we would go ask for bread from the bakeries, they'd give it to us because we looked, I don't know, I guess we looked forlorn, or I don't know.
So. Do you have any encounters with wildlife in various forms?
What I'm going to call it, wildlife. Well, you know, bugs, the big centipedes and stuff. There were lots of those, lots of rats, lots of... The Koreans used to take the centipedes and put them on leashes and take them around, and then the doc would inject them with something and they'd die.
Wow.
I mean, those were the biggest water buffalo and pigs and chickens and things weren't wildlife.
Mm.
I mean, we didn't see many snakes.
Tigers, elephants.
Never saw any of that stuff.
Mm.
No.
Okay.
No. Centipedes, big centipedes, big bugs.
Mm.
Especially when you're digging underground. We lived underground, so you know, you gotta
okay.
get bugs and rats.
All right. Any encounters with, well, I had mentioned the NVA coming up. Any tunnel operations like that going into
Did
tunnels?
Did we go into tunnels?
Yeah.
Not me.
No.
But we had Koreans who did that sort of thing.
They
yeah.
did encounter
yeah.
quite a bit.
I didn't have to do that, no. No way.
Yeah, it's sort of a little insane.
Yeah.
But, okay. Now... I guess heading home early, what was the experience like? First of all, leaving, I'm sure it was quite a relief.
I was glad to leave.
Getting back home, hello, impressions, anything that stands out?
Yeah, getting back home was the worst.
Really?
You know, you arrive back in the country, you know, there's no parades, there's nothing, you just rotate back.
Mm-hmm.
You just arrive at an airport, somebody gives you an envelope and then you're on your way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to go visit my sister. My family, in fact, was overseas, so I went to visit my sister. And she, at the time, was a avid anti-war protester and just was all over me like a cheap suit. I didn't need that.
Really?
And so that was my welcome home, was my sister calling me baby killer and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent a very short period of time with her and then took off. In fact, I checked in at my next duty station early because
really?
I was just done with it. I didn't want to deal with the way that country.
Were you aware of the anti-war sentiment coming back?
No, I mean, we weren't real aware of it. I mean, you hear a little bit about it, read a little bit about it, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something I certainly wasn't ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't ready for that.
Oh, I'm sure that was quite harsh coming back to that.
So I was ready to go to Quantico.
Yeah. All right. I guess anything else you'd like to discuss about your time in Vietnam? Okay. All right. I guess we can we'll end this now. This will end the interview with Mr. Steve Harding on April 11th.